Today on the Best of Flashpoints, Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, on war crimes charges filed against Bush administration officials in Spain, Norbert Friedman reporting on the ground in Palestine on commemorations of Land Day, and African debt relief in the G20. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein and Norbert Friedman. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. You may have heard a Spanish court has agreed to consider charging six former members of the Bush administration on alleged torture charges, war crimes charges at Guantanamo, among other places. And we have been following this story for some time. So has our first guest, Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie Cohn is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, most recently the author Too Soon to Be, or is it out now? Yes?
It will be out in mid to late April.
36 seconds. Rules of Disengagement, the Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie Cohn, you have written also about all the potential crimes and war crimes and sort of violations of law, national and international, by the Bush administration. What is your response and what is the significance of the Spanish judge sort of, if you will, threatening to Pinochet members of the Bush administration?
Well, Spain is considering doing what the United States should be doing. When we ratified the Convention Against Torture, we agreed that we would prosecute and punish violations of the Convention Against Torture. And there have been recent admissions by members of the Bush administration, former members of the Bush administration, to torture, to waterboarding, etc. And waterboarding, as we know, has long constituted torture under U.S. law. Torture is a war crime and is punishable under the federal statute called the War Crimes Act. Now, Judge Garzón, referred the case to a Spanish prosecutor to determine whether or not to proceed with prosecutions against these six people. And I'll tell you who they are. John Yoo, and your listeners know him well. He is a local up there before he went to Orange County, I think, to escape all of the attention he was getting in Berkeley. But he is a law professor at Berkeley Law School. William Haynes, who is working for Chevron now and used to be the vice presidential, the Department of Defense General Counsel. David Addington, who was Cheney's chief of staff. Alberto Gonzalez, of course, was the attorney general and White House counsel. Jay Bybee was the assistant attorney general during the Bush administration and is now a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And former Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith. They were members of the so-called War Council. And, of course, there were many others who have not been or not under investigation in Spain, as we know. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Ashcroft, Tenet, etc. So Judge Garzón referred this case to the Spanish prosecutor under Spain's universal jurisdiction law. And I think we've talked about universal jurisdiction before, but just to refresh people's recollections, many countries, including the United States, have these universal jurisdiction laws, and they allow a country to prosecute a foreign national, even if there's no direct relationship with the prosecuting country, because certain crimes are considered so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity, and any country can punish them. Now, universal jurisdiction does not come into play if the country that the national is a national of is doing its job. So if the United States were launching an investigation against these former officials of the Bush administration, then countries like Spain wouldn't have to investigate them. Now, an interesting note is that Spain has been investigating charges of torture against Israel in Gaza, and as a result, the Spanish legislature is considering the repeal of Spain's universal jurisdiction law. Ironically, Israel used universal jurisdiction to try, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct relationship with Israel. There were some attempts during the Bush administration to bring some of the officials of the Bush administration to justice, such as Belgium, which initiated proceedings against Rumsfeld. The Bush administration threatened Belgium, said, we're going to pull the headquarters of NATO out of Brussels if you don't drop these charges, and Belgium capitulated and dropped the charges. And there was a short period of time where Rumsfeld couldn't travel abroad for fear he would be arrested. Also, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, other groups, asked the German federal prosecutor to investigate Rumsfeld and other Bush officials. But with some variable pressure from the Bush administration, the German federal prosecutor said no. So the question is, what will happen if arrest warrants issue, if the Spanish prosecutor takes the case and issues arrest warrants, if the legislature doesn't first dilute Spain's universal jurisdiction law so that it won't be used against Israel, and if arrest warrants do issue, then Spain or any of the 24 nations that participate in the European Extradition Convention would have to could arrest any of these six people if they traveled abroad and came to any of these countries in Europe. The question is going to be what Obama does. Well, Obama certainly will not extradite these people to Spain. The question is whether he will interfere with these prosecutions the way Bush interfered with prosecutions during the Bush administration. Will the Obama administration threaten Spain, for example, or threaten these other countries? And then the other question is, I'm saying when because I think it is inevitable, as these torture memos come out, and some are imminent, some of the worst are going to be released soon, evidently, and as these congressional commissions develop this testimony, I think it's the tip of the iceberg, what we've seen so far. I don't think Obama and Eric Holder are going to have any choice but to proceed with investigations and prosecutions. Obama reportedly would like to hold off until the end of his first term, the beginning of his second term, so he can take care of the economy and Afghanistan and all of the other things on his plate. But he may not be able to wait that long. So it's a very, very positive development, and I think we're going to see more of this. I think that
let me just jump in here for a second, because I want to talk just a little bit about how an investigation, Marjorie Cohen, like this would proceed. This judge appoints an investigator. Does this investigator begin to subpoena? Do these investigators, are they allowed to make visits to, say, the United States to pursue information? How does an investigation like this unfold?
Well, it's interesting, and there hasn't been a lot of precedent, although I have to say that the United States recently prosecuted and sentenced, a federal court in Miami sentenced Chucky Taylor, the son of the former Liberian president, to 97 years in federal prison for torture, even though the crime were committed in Liberia, and we did that under the United States Universal Jurisdiction Law, and in that sense, the federal court had jurisdiction over Chucky Taylor and proceeded as we do with investigations and witness interviews and documents. It's a little trickier when you don't have jurisdiction over the people, but there's so much in the media. There are books like Mine, Cowboy Republic, which make the case. There are the torture memos and other documents that are out there in the public realm. And there will invariably be, if this lawsuit or this complaint proceeds, witness interviews and further investigation. Let me just say that the court documents say, and this is in Spain, that without the legal advice from these legal eagles, such as you and Bybee and Addington and Haynes, It would have been impossible to structure a legal framework that supported what happened at Guantanamo. And the lawsuit claims, and this is what it claims, that these six former officials of the Bush administration, quote, participated actively and decisively in the creation, approval, and execution of a judicial framework that allowed for the deprivation of fundamental rights of a large number of prisoners, the implementation of new interrogation techniques, including torture, the legal cover for the treatment of those prisoners, the protection of the people who participated in illegal tortures, and above all, the establishment of impunity for all the government workers, military personnel, doctors, and others who participated in the detention center at Guantanamo, unquote. And the key word there, Dennis, is impunity. This is a word that is used in international human rights law to signify a situation where people get away with the most heinous crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. And the most important thing is that these people not get away with torture, with murder, because that would be impunity, and that's why Spain is proceeding the way it is.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Marjorie Cohn about a decision by a Spanish court. Criminal proceedings have, in fact, begun in Spain against six senior officials of the Bush administration. Again, to restate, we're talking about Alberto Gonzalez. He's a former White House counsel and Attorney General David Addington, former Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Douglas Fife, who was the Undersecretary of Defense, William Haynes, formerly the Pentagon's General Counsel, and John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who were both senior Justice Department legal advisors. They're all now under investigation by this international court. And again, just very...
No, this is Spanish court.
I'm sorry. Question is, how does this Spanish court derive its power in the context of international law?
Well, Spain has ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, and other treaties that outlaw torture, just the way the United States has. And, for example, we have what's called the Supremacy Clause in our Constitution, which says that treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. And that means that when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law, and therefore people can be held liable for violations of that torture convention. Now, what the United States did was to enacted the torture statute to implement our obligations under the Convention Against Torture, under the treaty. And the war crimes statute provides for life imprisonment or even the death penalty for people who torture or participate in authorizing torture. And the death penalty would lie if the victim died. Now, It's not surprising that no one has been prosecuted yet under the torture statute. We also have the War Crimes Act, which specifies torture is a war crime. Nobody's been prosecuted under the War Crimes Act either. And so we really need to put pressure on the administration to use the laws that are on the books. There are these laws. There are federal laws against maiming, assault, stalking, and one of the interesting things, one of the torture memos, and I shouldn't say interesting, I should say alarming things about one of the torture memos that was written by John Yoo, is that he said that he was going to recommend that the Department of Justice not enforce these federal statutes against torture, maiming, assault, and stalking. The federal maiming statute is really quite something. It prohibits someone from cutting, slitting, or biting the lip or other member of the body, or pouring caustic acid over a person. And these were the kinds of things that John Yoo said, hey, if that happens, we're not going to prosecute. All's fair in this so-called war on terror. So there's some pretty serious things that went on during the Bush administration. And as Obama said, nobody's above the law. We are a nation of laws. And whether it's politically feasible or not for him and his attorney general to proceed with investigations of these Bush officials, it needs to be done because we are a nation of laws. And other countries look and see that we're not taking care of business, and it creates even more animosity against us. Some military officials recently said that the two leading recruitment factors for terrorists were Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And so this has actually, the Bush policy has actually made us less safe safe under the guise of making us more safe.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with Marjorie Cohen. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She teaches law at Thomas Jefferson down south in California. She is the author of the soon-to-be-released Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, and has written books and lots of articles about the various potential war crimes and crimes against humanity of the Bush administration. Okay, Marjorie, I want to get you to respond to a couple of the responses to these investigations. Here's Obama saying, I guess he said this in January when asked about if there would be an investigation. Obviously, I'm quoting him, we're going to be looking at past practices, and I don't believe that anybody is above the law. My orientation's going to be to move forward. He says, we've got to move forward. Can you move forward and bury this kind of truth?
No, Dennis, you can't move forward without looking backward, because if we move forward without taking care of business, without taking care of what happened in the past, then history will repeat itself, and there will be other well-meaning leaders of the United States that will engage in the same kind of behavior because they'll know that they will not be brought to justice. Obama does not want to alienate the Republicans. Of course, they're alienated already, no matter what he does anyway. But he wants this bipartisanship. He wants to be perceived as a uniter, not a divider, and he would just prefer that we move forward and not bring anyone to justice. He doesn't want it to be perceived as a witch hunt. This is not a witch hunt where you pursue independent investigations of lawbreaking. And interestingly, Michael Mukasey, you'll recall he was Bush's third attorney general, said he didn't think there was any liability because these people were acting in good faith because they thought that they were protecting the country. Now, the good faith defense just doesn't fly, and Michael Mukasey should know better. He was a federal judge for many years. I have been a criminal defense attorney, and I can't imagine what would happen. Well, I know what would happen if I walked into court with my client who was charged with robbery and said, my client robbed that bank because it was supporting genocide in Darfur, and he acted in good faith because he wanted to stop the genocide. They would probably laugh me out of court. So this good faith defense just won't cut it. Another defense is that, well, we were just relying on the advice of our lawyers. Michael Isikoff of Newsweek said that there are emails between the White House and these lawyers, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, David Addington, William Haynes, and we don't know what they say, and we don't know if they will ultimately be made public. But that could be the smoking gun, where you have people like Cheney, and Seymour Hersh said some interesting things about how powerful Cheney is today on Terry Gross, and also in his recent New Yorker piece. But Cheney Colin Powell's former right-hand man, Lawrence Wilkerson, said that the torture emanated from the vice president's office. So if there are emails from Cheney's office through Addington, David Addington, who is widely believed to be the chief architect of this program where these lawyers were justifying basically torture and other war crimes, if you have emails where Cheney's office says, give us the legal backing or give us some legal arguments to enable us to commit these to torture, then that's the smoking gun. And of course, there are already a number of smoking guns. Cheney admitted he authorized waterboarding. There were several people who met in the basement of the White House and authorized waterboarding. John Yoo wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently saying that there was waterboarding that went on and it was perfectly fine. But it's not just waterboarding. There are many, many other techniques, not just torture, but also cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which also violate our treaty obligations.
Well, we're running out of time, but if you were a lawyer for one of these guys, defending one of these guys, because somebody's going to have to defend them if they end up in court, would you tell them now in preparation not to bother, say, traveling to certain places in the world?
Yes. I mean, if this goes forward, and there haven't been arrest warrants issued yet in Spain, but if and when there are, they're going to have trouble traveling to not just Spain, but several other European countries that have extradition agreements with Spain. They're going to have to watch it because they could travel to another country and be arrested. So, yes, I certainly would.
Is Pinochet... Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to say that you wouldn't really be...
I would not represent them.
Sorry.
I would prosecute them, and you know, I can't imagine ever prosecuting anyone because I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years, but these people I would prosecute. In fact, I wrote an indictment against Alberto Gonzalez once. It's called the Gonzalez Indictment, and it was quite an exercise for me who had been a criminal defense attorney for so long. But I quite enjoyed it, actually.
Okay, and in the final minute, is the arrest of Augusto Pinochet, who was arrested in Great Britain, pursued, investigated, and indicted by the same Spanish judge, is this in any way a precedent?
Yes, that is that. Well, he didn't ultimately get tried for various reasons, but he certainly was arrested under universal jurisdiction. And this judge, Baltasar Garzón in Spain, was very involved in that prosecution. So, yes, there have been instances of prosecution. As I said, Adolf Eichmann recently in the United States, Chucky Taylor, and there have been other instances as well. It's a very well-established doctrine, and we're going to see more countries jumping on the bandwagon and investigating and hopefully prosecuting some of these Bush officials. And hopefully Obama will do his job and Eric Holder as well and bring them to justice.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, thank you for all your great work on this front. I want to tell people again, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and the book is coming up, is Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. People want to look for that, and we will look for you as this story unfolds. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
In Bethlehem, occupied West Bank, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Yesterday, across occupied Palestine, Palestinians inside the Green Line and in the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip commemorated Land Day, an annual event created to call attention to historical and current-day apartheid and confiscation of Palestinian land by the Israeli state. This year's 33rd anniversary day of protests was also combined with the first annual global boycott, divestment, and sanctions day as a means of attaching historical struggle for land and justice with proactive strategies to counter today's apartheid policies. In Deir Hanna in the north, thousands of Palestinians marched and held a rally near an olive grove in this village nestled between rolling green hills and the blue sea of Galilee. Flags of different political factions whipped in the wind, and the intergenerational crowd wore buttons and stickers encouraging boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Hazem Jamjoum of Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights.
After 1948, the Israeli state continued to confiscate land en masse. In 1976, they announced a plan to confiscate several thousand dunams of land in this area, around Sakhnin and Arabe and Deir Hanna, where we are today. And what happened was the community and mainly the left organized the general strike that basically brought out the entire population of this area on strike and who started to demonstrate. And so on March 30th, 1976, all the demonstrations went out into the streets and the Israeli police and army opened fire onto the demonstrators, killing six and injuring several hundred people and arresting several thousand. And so that began, Palestinians commemorate this as Land Day or Yom Al-Ard. And so every year since 1976, Land Day is one of the most important days on the Palestinian calendar around the world. And these days, what's been happening is Land Day is used as a day to protest further land confiscation. And since Palestinians everywhere are facing land confiscation, there are demonstrations across historic Palestine, specifically in the West Bank and inside the Green Line, demonstrating to defend Palestinian land.
And today is also Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Day. What's the significance of that, especially here in Deir Hanna?
Well, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement in the rest of the world is one of the key, or the key way, of acting out in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Inside Palestine, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions is part of a larger philosophy of non-cooperation. And so for Palestinian citizens of Israel, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS, is essentially the building of local economy. It's beginning to be able to rely on ourselves here, and also developing further links between Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinian refugees.
Makbul al-Nassar is an activist and accomplished photographer from Arabe.
My name is Makbul al-Nassar. I'm from Arabe, and Arabe is one of the villages that one of the triangle, the villages of the land day in 1976.
And can you tell me a little bit about why you're here today, why it's important for people from your community to be here?
I am in the land day each year since I was 5, and I was born 2 years before the land day. So this is some kind of tradition, political tradition. It's a tradition of our struggle also. It's a symbol of our struggle that we, each year we commit, we stay holding our principles, our rights. We, even though that our lands that was confiscated in 76 was returned by struggle, but although the Israeli policy is still continuing, meeting the same policy of less Palestinians and more land with the Zionist authorities. So our struggle will never end till the occupation will end, until our rights will be returned and our lands will be returned, and the right of return for the refugees will be also accomplished. So this is a tradition and a symbol of our struggle that will never stop, and you will see me, the generation that have been born in the years of the land day, and the children and the old men, everybody will hold this symbol as the first resistance of the Israeli occupation inside the Green Line.
And there are a lot of children here too. Can you talk a little bit about how the children are growing up these days with the aggravated, you know, accelerated settler movement and the Zionists and their struggle?
The same control strategy that Israel is doing since 60 years with the Palestinians inside Israel is making the Palestinians ignorant about our history and about our lands, about our political issues, and about our ID. But in the last maybe 15 years, we have more and more awareness. We have more and more ways and new ways to handle this package and this kind of knowledge to the next generation. And I'm so happy to see the children actually really understanding why they are here and why we are struggling, and who are they also to know that they are Palestinians, and the others are the one who's occupying us.
And finally, this is also a Global Boycott Divestment Sanctions Day, Global BDS Day, yeah? And you're wearing a sticker. Can you tell me what your sticker says and why, how important Global BDS is?
It's a sticker for boycotting Israel, because I think that the same way that happened with apartheid in South Africa, we will struggle inside. In the West Bank, there's daily life struggle all the time. And I think that there's a lot of people in the world who actually identify with our issue and with our struggle. But it needs strategies. Boycotting Israel could be a good strategy that could be a price that Israel will be hurted by in order to change its policies. And without this voice, I think we need the world with us to boycott Israel in order to succeed. It's gathering hands together from all over the world, from all those who want or who dream of freedom and justice in the world.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Raja Al-Khatib is the mayor of Deir Hanna, and we asked him about the historical and current significance of Land Day in this community.
Together with Sakhnin and Arrabe, Deir Hanna has the honor of being one of the three villages from which the original Land Day demonstrations were launched as part of the 1976 general strike. Since then, there has been a rotation of the central Land Day demonstration, which is held in one of the three villages each year. The spark for the 1976 Land Day demonstration was ignited in Deir Hanna, in this field where we are standing, and where this year's commemoration is taking place.
عليها وأقمنا عليها الاحتفال.
مظاهرة يوم الأرض في سنة 76 كانت ردة فعل جماهيرية.
Demonstrations of Land Day in 1976 were a popular Palestinian response to the continued Israeli confiscation of Palestinian land and resources. Does Deir Hanna still face any of these issues today?
أهالي قرية دير حنا اليوم.
In general, what we have represented today are the demands of our people, the Palestinian people, as a whole, and not the issues facing Deir Hanna in particular. However, Deir Hanna faces the same issues that face Palestinians in all of our cities, towns, and villages, ranging from discrimination in the Israeli government's budget allocations to the confiscation and annexation of our lands by the regional councils of nearby exclusively Jewish settlements, as well as incredibly high unemployment and poverty rates. We also face systematic and institutionalized discrimination as Palestinians in every aspect of our lives as individuals and as a community. Today's demonstration is particularly important because we have joined with other Palestinians around the world in opposing the explicit rise of fascism in the Israeli political system, an ascendance which was painfully clear in the latest Israeli election, in which Avigdor Lieberman, a well-known racist, joined by a large contingent of Knesset members, are poised to take power. As such, we have every right to be extremely worried about our fate, at least with regards to how the Israeli state looks at us Palestinian citizens, especially if Lieberman ends up taking control over one of the ministries with power over the Palestinian community.
ليبرمان في إحدى الوزارات التي لها علاقة خدماتية مع الوسط العربي.
آخر سؤال أستاذي. إيش كيف رضاكم؟
How do you feel today's demonstration went, and what effect do you think it will have on the Palestinian national movement?
نحن نقول أن هذه الاجتماعات تنمي وتغرس الانتماء.
Actions like the one today entrench and enhance the strength and consciousness of our youth. These youth who did not experience the first Land Day in 1976. It is essential that the older generation passes on its experience and the lessons of the struggle to the younger generations, so they can use it to carry on the struggle.
Land Day / Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, BDS Day, was commemorated across Palestine, with protests not only inside the Green Line, where the original Israeli attacks took place, but also inside occupied East Jerusalem, as well as numerous cities, towns, and villages in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. And across the international spectrum, over 80 actions in 20 cities worldwide took part in the Global BDS Day, where activists organized protests, sit-ins, and consumer boycotts targeting Israeli corporations, academic and cultural institutions, and sports teams. In the West Bank city of Ramallah, Jamal Juma'ah, director of the Stop the Wall campaign, talked about the various other actions that took place on March 30th and why it was such a significant day of local and international protest.
You know, the Land Day for the Palestinians this year is like any, I think it has too many meanings. First of all, it came after Gaza and after all this like any attack from the Israeli government and its Zionist-like organizations on the Palestinians' lands for settlements. It come also with like any the more siege on the Palestinian people is much more restricted. It comes after Gaza massacres. At the same times, it came where the world, particularly the civil society around the world and movements, social movement, decide that Land Day will be the global day for action, particularly for BDS against Israel, boycott, divestment, and sanction. So as any Palestinian national movement and campaigns, we were preparing for many activities on the ground. Some of these activities were on the wall. It's representing the confrontation of the Israeli actions on the ground against the wall, against the settlements, where the people express their anger against that, to give the message around to the Israelis and to the world that, like, it's not acceptable and we will not surrender any after all this pressure that they are doing. The second is symbolic, which is like related to the land, which is mainly was going to the land and planting trees there and have some sittings and doing some national activities on the land itself represents the soul of the land day, which is to be attached to the land, to be committed to the land, to protect it, to not leave it. In Palestinians 48 also, this is very, very important occasion, as it is started from there, where they were in 70s. This is in 1676, where a massacre happened against them when six people has been at least injured, killed, and hundreds were injured when they attack a demonstration for the people going out to protest the confiscation of their land, which they are living in that state, what so-called Israel, supposed to be this is citizens. But they are attacked all the time, where they're attacked by this government. And the aim, we know, is to push them out of there and to take as much as their lands, surrendering them for strategic political reasons. That they don't want them there. This is simply what had happened. Since then, it was yearly an occasion where the Palestinians just remember that still we have an enemy who's doing the same, still doing it in much more even violently and much more worse in 48, and it's continue in much more worst ways in the West Bank. So the policies are the same. That means that the Israeli colonial Zionist project aiming to take the land and to push the people out, it's still remaining the same. It never changed. And in spite of all what we heard about peace talkings, about negotiations, about this slogans that doesn't mean to the Palestinians anything, because what we are, they are suffering on the ground, something totally different. And it will remain the land day. It will remain every year a remarkable day that marks the Palestinians steadfastness in their land, and they won't give it up.
Jamal Juma, can you talk about the significance of combining this commemoration of Land Day with the first annual Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Day, Global BDS Day around the world? What's the significance of attaching those two movements and commemorations together?
And Palestinian cause doesn't, in way or another, disconnected from other people's struggles in the world. And this is not just now, I think, since it was. All the time, all the years, the decades where the Palestinians were struggling for their freedom and for their liberation and for their rights, there was a kind of recognitions and being attached with other issues like them, like our cause. Support for the Palestinian struggle was all the time there. It differs according to the periods, but it was from Asia, it was from Latin America, it was from Africa, from the Arab countries, from movements in Europe and maybe in the States, but it was there all the time because this is just cause. And by time it became one of the causes, and the struggles became a symbolic struggle for peoples who's keep going and insisting and struggling for their rights and for their independence. This year, I would say, especially after the massacres of Gaza, it became totally shown or a symbolic to the resistance, real resistance that come out, the resistance and solidarity that come out from the world everywhere, resisting any kind of human abusing, massacres against civilians. It came symbolic to the people, from the people that fed up from the occupation, fed up from all this continuous abusing of human rights, undermining the people's rights and people's lives. That's why this year it became so worldwide, willing from the people to join an activity to solidarity, to show that their solidarity and back up to the Palestinians in their national struggle for their national rights. We feel that it's not anymore people will be tolerant with Israeli crimes, and they are fed up even with their governments, from being tolerant with this with these crimes. So it was in Belém, in Brazil, and for the social forum, to all the movements, all the organizations around the world, networks, to agree that we will have the Land Day as a day for punishing and for worldwide struggle, global struggle, together to solidarity with Palestine, to show that we are on the same line. And this then doesn't make me surprised when it comes from movements MST, from indigenous communities, from different social movements in Asia and Latin America and then in United States and Europe. It's clear how the whole world became totally divided between global colonial powers, and we see how where they led the whole world to wars, war crimes, financial crisis, social crisis, tension will be what was in the last 20 years around the world. And on the other hand, it became very noticeable, the peoples come close together, where they see that there is a need for combining efforts in order to be able to confront such a monster policies that clearly it's destroying the world. So I think this is part of it. And also people realize that Israel is one of the center cornerstones even of these powers in the Middle East. So we are very optimistic that these efforts will become fruitful, and fruitful soon. Now it is in a kind of initiatives that come from different organizations, countries around here and there. But we are sure that it's going to be a global phenomenon everywhere. Already the Israelis complaining in their newspapers about how it became difficult for them, because everywhere, wherever they go, they are questioned by what they're going. So it's not, I think, even if the governments, European Union, United States, United Nations, didn't question Israel until now for their crimes, and they are giving them the green line to do it whenever they want, because they did it in Beirut, in Lebanon, 2006, nobody talked to them. They did it in 2009, 2008, 2009 in Gaza, worse than they did it in Beirut. And we find out that the European leaders, the second day of ending the war, they come to congratulate them here and to give them permission to do it whenever they want. Even Obama, when he came to power, he didn't say any serious word about what had happened. And he was still in the line of Palestine, following the steps of George Bush. Well, this is total unfortunate, unfortunate that he's doing like this. But on the other hand, we see how the people reactions is promising. We are more than a time before, in spite of all this heavy pressure that we are under, that the future is us. And we are going to win. We saw the sympathy. We saw that people anger started to become actions on the ground. And we think this is the beginning of the road. It's not going to take too much time.
And already, just here at the end of March, an Israeli financial newspaper, I believe it's called The Market, just released a report saying that just the last 4 months alone, 21% of Israeli exporters are losing business directly connected to the growing global boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. So it is having a very rapid effect. And I believe that about 64% say that it's had at least some effect. So can you talk about the importance of the international civil society joining in the BDS movement right now, and how you think people should proceed with the next steps?
I'm happy that the message of the world started to get to them. They started to understand it. Because the unlimited support that they have been given by Europe, by the regimes around the world, by the United States government, just make them much more arrogant and much more racist, and looking down to the human beings' lives even, and even mentalities, undermining them. Even they terrorize the people around the world for decades. Anyone want to talk against Zionism as a racist ideology, it became like threatened and became chased and became punished, and it's still going on. They didn't finish. But they started to feel that they are not above the human beings. They are not from like different planet. They are part of this planet, and their hands is not free to kill whenever they want, to keep abusing the people as they want, to take whatever they want, and to, at the same time, to go travel to the world as if they are civilized like people who's like any very welcome. Even still, they are there to call themselves the victims, in spite of all the crimes that they are doing against the people here. This is not going to be without any price. They are going to be to pay heavy price for this. And it's better for them just to learn this lesson from now. This is a sentence. And they have to learn the lesson from this sentence. Because if they keep dealing with the world in an arrogant way like this, they are going to pay a real heavy price out of this. What we want as a people, we want our rights. We want to live like any other people in the world. We want to enjoy seeing something called like security for us as a people. We want to see like any hope for the future, like for us and for our next generations. With what they are doing, they just like killing every single hope that we could have as a people, as a nation, and as a human beings. This, I don't think that it's acceptable. It's past the time when genocide can be done to a people, like what happened to the Native Americans in the United States, which is why I was hoping that Obama, first when he come to the power, to apologize to his people, to that people, that they were genocides. And the Latin America, New Zealand, Australia, and Africa, and different parts of the world. Colonization, yani genocide actions, and like ethnic cleansing, and like yani slavery, I think it is not acceptable. And it came to the point that the world would say that's not acceptable. They say it at the end of last century, when it finished like the whole apartheid system in South Africa by a global power, global people power, like when they stand up and they say, no, we are not going to deal with racist people who's like practicing apartheid against other nation. And it fall. But like Israel was still exceptional, that they can do this and nobody talked to them, that it's not acceptable. But it seems after 20 years from, or 16 years from failing the South African apartheid regime, people recognize that they can't keep Israel exceptional, because they did keep it exceptional. They commit since in the last 16 years one of the worst crimes that have been committed in the 21st century, and I would say in the last century. So I would repeat like any the word like Livni said, like when she started want to justify her crimes and her in Gaza, when she said enough is enough. And I think that the world is telling them enough is enough. This is your words. Enough is enough. It's not anymore can be continue like this. This is needs. It can't continue like this. I think it needs from the people to become much more like organized, strategized with these things. Continue like insisting on this line until it gets real fruits. Or until at least Israel started to recognize and stop what they were doing. Human rights is not for negotiations. Human rights should be put in on the ground. And peace is not just a slogan. Peace is a practice that you have to practice it on the ground. Human rights is not just a slogan. People have to see it. So that's what I think the message that the world is giving. And at the end, we have the right on our side as a Palestinian people and the people who's in solidarity. And that's where their strength is coming from.
That was Jamal Juma'a, director of the Stop the Wall campaign in the West Bank city of Ramallah. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, with special thanks to Becca Wolf and Hazem Jamjoum. Reporting from the West Bank, Occupied Palestine, this is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The group Africa Action called yesterday on the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to cancel the $300 billion of illegitimate debt owed by African nations. This, of course, happening in the context of the G20 meetings and lots of protests. You'll hear more on that later. In the face of shocking and grim statistics, says Africa Action, on the impact, in the face of shocking and grim statistics on the impact of the economic crisis in Africa, it's more important now than ever that President Obama and his economic team act to stop the global economic meltdown and protect the poor. Quote, shrinking markets combined with the credit crunch means that governments will have less money to spend on important sectors such as education, health, and women's empowerment as economic survival becomes their number one goal. That, according to Gerald Lamel, he's the executive director of Africa Action. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Mr. Lamel, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hey, Dennis. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And, of course, Africa wasn't in the core of what was going on in London, although maybe it should have been. In fact, it was sort of not a part of it. But just your thoughts generally about what you see happening there and in the context of the call for debt relief.
Well, it's very interesting what is happening. The debate going on right now at the G20 conference is really about whether to develop a huge global stimulus package, generally for the European and U.S. markets, whether to use tax cuts as a stimulus, and basically, bandying about the usual or the typical, actually the non-typical free market prescriptions. Stimulus it seems to be the preferred method right now. Yet there is no discussion of providing some sort of stimulus for the poor countries down in Africa and elsewhere around the world. And it is ironic that after 60 years of Bretton Woods and certainly 30 years of the U.S. making structural adjustment, a key part of any economic negotiations with Africa, it is ironic that the very methods that Africans were suggesting they use to help develop their infrastructure and their social issues and concerns, those very issues are being used by the United States and others to help stimulate our economy.
Even now, as the G20 talk about money and more money than ever before for developing nations, for poor nations, they're talking about in the context of the IMF and the World Bank, and they're talking about in the context of this sort of go-go banking era that they don't really seem to want to restrain.
Absolutely. It is fascinating. And people will read in the paper tomorrow that it'll say $1.1 trillion in loans for developing countries and think that this is a wonderful thing and that this is going to be very helpful. But the fact of the matter is this is $1.1 trillion in loans, not stimulus, loans, and loans through the International Monetary Fund. Now, the International Monetary Fund maintains these harmful conditions which call for maintaining budget surpluses, privatizing infrastructure and social needs, including things like electricity, transportation, water, maintaining inflation targeting, raising interest rates, removing protection from international economic volatility, revoking workers' rights. These are actually literally in an advice document put out by the IMF to the South African government just a couple of months ago. This is precisely the kind of thing that has prevented Africa from ever becoming competitive. The whole goal here is to make sure that the European and American markets can have access unfettered to the African markets to the detriment of people. We have not seen these economic prescriptions result in an alleviation of poverty across the continent. We still have 87% of sub-Saharan Africans living on $2 a day, and that has not changed. And we have a small number of Africans, generally the political elite, who have gotten wealthy because they've been pulled into the deals and by the big Western companies. And since they have a stake in it, they'll protect the investment. But the people suffer.
And of course, in this program by the IMF and the World Bank, it supports major corporations and their efforts. You know, Hollywood actors, nothing wrong with them caring about what's going on in Africa. But the way in which this trickles down, if you will, also includes, like, you know, forcing the use of genetically engineered seed instead of local farming, local business, supporting micro banking. So there are real problems here.
Sure, absolutely. In fact, what it's doing is making it very easy for heavily subsidized Western agricultural products to be dumped into Africa at very cheap cost, thereby undermining what is the major gross product in Africa, and that is agriculture. 80% of the GDP across the continent comes from agriculture, and the prescription here suggests that they need to subsume their agriculture to the more powerful Western interests. And this is just asking them to commit suicide. Yet this is done by negotiating with powerful leaders in African countries that if we'll give you a cut if you allow us to operate unfettered. The problem with this, even if people agree that, you know, feel that, well, hey, it's dog eat dog, if we win, we win. The fact of the matter is, in Madagascar, we saw the Madagascar Action Plan, which actually called for these very strict free market principles to be applied in Madagascar. It allowed oil companies to come in. Just the government basically took land from people and sold it to the oil companies. The oil, energy, and mining companies had unfettered access to the Madagascar market, and the Malagasy people united in opposition and overthrew the government, and the military went with the people, which was a dramatic change from what has happened in the past. I think this is a sign that Africa is no longer going to accept these prescriptions because there's nothing for them in it. They're not intended to benefit from it, and they aren't benefiting from it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Gerald Lamel, a pleasure speaking with you. You're the executive director of Africa Action, and I'm hoping that we can keep this excellent dialogue going.
Yeah, love to do it, Dennis, and thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.